We are in Shmuel Bet. We are starting the 8th chapter. We're on page 250, a new packet. And the parak begins with the words, Vayhi Achrei Chein. And it was after this happened. So obviously this chapter is a connection to the previous one. And the previous parak discussed how David, his dreams did not come true. He was not able to build the Beis HaMikdash, but nonetheless a dynasty would be created that his children would remain as kings, as well as be the ones who will build the Beis HaMikdash. So Vayhi Achrei Chein is going to mean that what we're going to see here is something connected to those dreams and aspirations that he had in the previous parak. So the pasuk says, Vayach David es plishtim v'yachniyim. So he began to fight against and to defeat the plishtim, and he was able to defeat them and subdue or to humble them. Vayikach David es meseg ha'amam yad plishtim. And David was able to take from the plishtim meseg ha'ama. And how's that translated in English for us? Meseg ha'ama is translated, not a very big help, translating as meseg ha'ama. Okay. So I guess we'll have to figure out what that means. Meseg ha'ama, actually, we're going to see in Rashi, but as we looked in the English, you can see that I underline meseg ha'ama underneath. It's translated as the harness of the arm. Metek Amma, as you can also see in the Masudah Sion, Metek is Hukain Resen Asoyil Hanigba Habahema. So it's the reins in which you pull, in which you're able to guide an animal. So if you're able to hold on to that rope, the wildest animal is in your control. You're in complete control. And Amma, as Masudah Sion says, is Amas Hazaroa, which represents the arm. Person is holding on to these straps. So David was able to pull the strings, if you will, of being able to be in complete control over the plishtim. How was he able to have this meseg ha'ama? It must mean that he had possession of something which was a central place for the plishtim. And that's what Rashi says. If we look in Rashi, Rashi tells us meseg ha'ama, quoting the words of in Chronicles of Devar Hayomim, Ksiv, Vayikach David as Gas miad plishtim, that he was able to conquer Gas. Vayhi Nikras Meseg Am. This was considered to be the Metek Ama, which is the harness of the arm, the most powerful, most important strategic place to conquer. Shem Shumakoro de Bechol Plishtim. That when a person is holding on to this, this is his ability to conquer and to rule over all over the plishtim. Shomatzina b'chol tzani plishtim ba'azav ashdod ve'akron ve'ashkelon shem malchus el b'gas metzina. We only find in this one place any mention of malchus, of reigning, of kingship. All these other places that were occupied by plishtim we do not find. So therefore, Gas is basically translated as capital city. It was D.C., the capital. And that was the capital of the plishtim. So therefore, that's the reason why the pasuk considers what David conquers, even though it doesn't say that he conquered Gas, but everyone knew that Gas was the meseg ha'ama. That once he had control of that city, he was able to control over everything and everyone. If we look in the words of the Radak, which are in the bottom, the first wide line, actually, in the Radak, which I do have underlined, quoting a pasuk in, first he quoted a pasuk in Bereishis, which we're not going to see, but the first wide line begins like this. Amru, with regard to Avimelech, who was speaking to Yitzchak, he said, Yodim anu she'aseh kadosh baruch halitin l'chal ozarach es kol ratzos eilet. Avimelech was no fool. He knew that God was on the Jewish people's side, and he realized that if he did not make a covenant, some type of a bris with Yitzchak, now his descendants, long after Abimelech was no longer around, still he wanted to make sure that the plishtim were safe from the possible defeat of the Jewish people. And therefore, he said, I know that God is going to end up giving you a bunch of property. Do me a favor and let's create a bris so that your descendants will not take over the land of the Plishtim. And Yitzchak, whether he should have done this, maybe he shouldn't have done it, but he did it. He did make a covenant, a bris, with Avimelech, who was the king of the Plishtim. So, what do you do when you make a covenant? You have to give something which shows a meeting of the minds. So, the Radak says, Ma'asa Yitzchak, what did he do? Kars ama achas memesek hachamor. He took off the reins, or this rope, which was tied to his donkey, and he cut it off. Shahayu rochival of this animal that he was riding upon, v'nosan lahem. And Yitzchak symbolically gave over these reins to Avimelech, as though to say, this is a sign of our covenant, that I'm not going to rule over you. Like, I control my chamor with this, I'm cutting it off, so you should know that I'm not going to control you, my descendants will not control you. Ukashamalach David, and when many years went by, the Radak tells us when David became David HaMelech, Ratzel Lovel Be'eretz Plishtim, so he wanted to go to this land, Vlo HaYochel, but he wasn't able to defeat and to conquer this property, Mikoch Osabris Meshvuos Yitzchak. He wasn't able to break the covenant of Yitzchak. Ad shelokach mehem os habris, until he took back from them this strap, this strip, this piece of rope. Shnemar biyikar David es mesek ama miad plishtim. V'yachakach lokach eretz plishtim. So, if you will, he broke into the museum where this thing was displayed with a big plaque that said, here is our guarantee that as long as we have this strap, we'll remember that Yitzchak made a covenant with our people, and therefore his children will not be able to fight against us. So what did he do? So when the Pasuk tells us, V'yikach David es mesek ha'ama, he was afraid if he would fight the Plishtim, everyone would point to this strap, to this rope, if you will, and say, look what you did. You broke the covenant. You don't respect the covenant of your forefathers. So that's why the Pasuk says he took it away.
I don't understand how he did it,
government. So he took it. Once it's no longer there, I will have to kill it.
I mean, that's true. It's not right. But the question is, I think it goes back to when this covenant was made. How specific in terms of a particular group, a particular part of the land? I think it's important to know that. I don't know if we do know that, because it does sound strange that he would take it back.
If Yaakov made
sure,
it,
sure.
Correct. It doesn't sound right. On one level, we can maybe say, maybe this bris was only for a specific amount of time, it's not forever. It's not so clear. The Miam Lois explains the words of the Radak in the following manner. He says that if we study Yitzchak at his lifetime after this covenant was made, we find that when it came to Yitzchak, that one of the things that happened with the Plishtim, we don't find a lot of stories, very few stories about Yitzchak. You know, it's very bizarre. So much about Abraham, very much about Yaakov. Yitzchak, this middle guy, is one of the few stories that we actually find is the story about the wells. And it's very much overlooked because everyone in Parshat Toldot, they always talk about the lentil soup, about the firstborn right and how Yaakov took it, whatever. But there is also the story about the wells. And one of them happened was the Plishtim took control and ended up closing up those wells. And Miam always explains something very fascinating. He says, you know, it's true, you have a bris. But a bris isn't a one-way street. A covenant is, I'll be peaceful with you so long as you're peaceful with me. But once the Plishtim are not respecting their end of the deal, they don't care about us, that they can take things which belong to us rightfully so. So they already broke the bris. And once the covenant has been destroyed, we don't have to keep it either. And that may be an interesting way of reminding ourselves of the year 2008 in Israel. It's the same thing. It's not just a one-way street. We have to follow the rules. They can do whatever they want. That's a whole other discussion. But that's the reason that he was able to do this. But still, because David was such a great person, he was concerned that if he would have this thing there, people are going to point to it and say, "Oh, the covenant, the covenant." So when it's convenient for them, they'll say, "Oh, what are you doing? How could you do this? We have a bris." But when it's also when they want to harm us and cause problems for us, they have no problem doing that either. So that's how some explain that idea. You had a thought.
David was not perfect. We know that he wasn't perfect. We have a whole team lead that he's.
Yeah, but then
he goes back and forth.
You could say that and everything, but I think there is much more to this story, and I think that's a valid.
I'm not saying it's that. I'm just saying that he's not perfect.
It makes more sense now. If, you know, once they break a contract and the contract's broken, it's going to be.
Right. Yeah. So, we're now going to continue to see, again, the question is, what on earth, how is this a connection to the previous parak? So we're going to continue to see that this has there's a lot of violence in this parak. There's a lot of bloodshed, there's a lot of war. It's not for the faint of heart, this parak. The idea is that David realized that he was not going to build a Beis HaMikdash. The reason why he was not going to build a Beis HaMikdash is because he was a man of war. And maybe he withheld himself for a little while fighting against his enemies because he realized this and he was hoping, I can build a Beis HaMikdash and then maybe afterwards I can somehow fight my enemies. Once he realized that he was not going to build the Beis HaMikdash, he realized that his one skill was war. And therefore he realized that the only way that his children were going to end up building the Beis HaMikdash is if he clears the path for them. And therefore, he decides to destroy all the enemies so that when I'm no longer king, my child will be able to easily build a Beis HaMikdash. There'll be no enemies, or the enemies will no longer want to start up with us. And not only that, we're also going to see that David is not going to take all the spoils of war for himself. He's going to set aside, and it's going to be specifically mentioned in these psukim, he sets aside all this money, all this wealth, the gold, the silver, the copper, for the raw materials for building the first Beis HaMikdash. Which the question is, how could he do so? How could we use such materials? That's something which we're going to talk about. But nonetheless, that's the connection. That David feels that he is now, I can't build a Beis HaMikdash, let me do everything in my power to make it easier for my next generation to be able to do that. Let's move on to the next pasuk. Pasuk Beit. Pasuk tells us, again, continuing with war, Vayach as Moab, so he began to fight against Moab, and he was killing Moab. And then he did something very bizarre. Now, he didn't kill all of Moab, but rather, V'yamadim b'chevel, he measured people out with a rope. Hash gave Osam Artsan. He had them lying down on the ground. Some people say what that means is, how are you going to have your enemies lying on the ground? They'll just get up and run away. The answer is, he used the rope and tied them down. He handcuffed them. The old-fashioned handcuffs was rope. V'imadeid shnei chavolim l'homis, l'mlo hachevel l'hachios. What he ended up doing is, instead of killing and wiping out all of Moab, the question is if they deserve to die, then why didn't he kill them all? If they didn't deserve to die, then why did he kill any of them? But instead of killing all of them, or none of them, he kills two-thirds. It's a very bizarre way that he does this, as the Torah says, that he would have them lying down, he'd have a rope, and he would measure two rope lengths, and those two people would die, and then the one who's the next on the line would live. Vatehi, which ends up being two of them would die, then the third one would live. So after the end of the day, you keep doing this little rope trick, you end up having one-third that lives. Again, why one-third? We'll explore two possible approaches to that in a moment. Concluding the pasuk, Vatehi Moab l'David l'avadim, Noisei Mincha. So you can imagine the few people that survived, or well, one third, which is actually not so few, those people ended up becoming avadim, subjects and servants to David. After all, they realized that they could have easily have died, and he saved their lives. Essentially, he kept them alive. Noisei Mincha, and they provided giving gifts and offerings to David and to his army. If we look on the map, just so that we have an idea of where is Moab, Moab is on the Transjordan. You see the Dead Sea. I have like a few maps over here, but this one is at least the first one, map 4, if you will, which is our first map. But nonetheless, it shows us where Moab was. And of course, Moab happens to be a direct relationship to David himself, because Moab was where Rus came from. So, on one hand, you can say, well, maybe that's the reason why he saved some of them, because he had some compassion. The fact that his great-grandmother came from Moab. But it certainly is a bizarre thing that he actually killed from his own. And in fact, it's brought down in the Gemara an interesting language. It says, Hainu de Amri Inshi, Menu Ve, Ablazel Bein Narga. Which means that the wooden axe is the very thing which chops down the trees in the forest, which is an expression that, you know, you're chopping down a forest, which is wood, and what is the thing that's doing the chopping? Well, you have a metal blade, but next to the metal blade is the wooden handle. So the wooden handle is contributing to the destruction of more wood. And on that is the comparison to David, who is related to Moab directly through his mother, and yet he was the one chopping down the forest, if you will, which was really from his own family. So that we're gonna discuss that, what exactly that means, a little bit more. If so, then why did he do it? Shouldn't he have shown more empathy, or maybe that was the one third, which was the sympathy that he showed? But let's begin with Rashi. Rashi, and then we'll see the Radak, which is a little bit more elaborate upon this, discusses why. Why was he so unbelievably violent when it came to Moab? When it comes to even the Plishtim, we don't find that he killed two-thirds of them. We don't see that. When it comes to Moab, he wipes out the majority of its inhabitants. So Rashi says as follows. It's a very interesting psychological idea. He says,
with the Plishtim, does it say how much? Did he kill all of them? Or?
He didn't kill all of them. Definitely he did not kill all of them.
It doesn't specify.
But to say that he killed two-thirds is a tremendous amount. Tens of thousands of people. Assuming, you know, a tremendous amount of people, for sure. So Rashi points this out. And says as follows: Lefi is the only Rashi on this verse. Lefi shehargu es aviv es imo ve'achav, because the people from Moab killed David's father, the people from Moab killed David's mother, as well as his brother. Shenemar, as the pasuk says in the 22nd chapter in the previous sefer Shmuel Aleph, it says v'yanachem es pnei melech Moab. We find that David, who was on the run from Shaul, and we'll see the Radak is a lot more explicit, discusses this. He placed his father and mother there because David was a soldier. You can imagine he was, you know, an American gladiator. He was a powerful man, a tremendous, tremendous soldier. He was able to run and hide and to fight. But to schlep his parents along on the ride is something which is above and beyond their physical abilities. So he decided, you know what I'm going to do? Is I'm going to put my family into the most trusted hands, and that must be Moab, because that's my family, right? And Moab is going to certainly protect my family. After all, I come from Moab. My great-grandmother comes. So what ended up happening, so the Rashi just says it very nicely, V'lo-matsinu shiotsu misham. We don't find that they ever left. Which doesn't mean that they stayed there for a long time and enjoyed it there so much that they didn't want to leave. It means they were killed. Sha'ul walked in there, and the king of Moab did not protest. He allowed those people of David to be killed. And on this, we can now... Sha'ul to kill him. Right. And that's a good connection, a good segue to the next words of the Radak. The Radak says, and I underlined a whole bunch of stuff over here, but it's looking at the wide lines, it's the fourth wide line, after we have the bold, it says, Derech Nekama Ubzoyim, that David wished to seek revenge against that which he had done, which they had done against his family. Skipping a few words, the Amru B'drash, it says in Medrash Tehillim, Ki Asazet Bavor L'Hamiso Aviv Ima Achav, he killed out his family. Kishenachim Osam Be'eretz Moab, he placed them, hoping that they would have been safe in this land, the land of Moab. Kishahaya Barech Meme Sha'ul, when the king, the first king of Israel, was chasing after David, which seemed to be endless. Commotion Amar V'enachim Es Pnei Melech Moab. So the king of Moab said, no problem, you can stay here, I'll protect them, they have nothing to worry about. Kishiyotze David Misham, as soon as David turned his back and started running away, and he had no choice, he had to continuously run away, Holch Ir Hamas, he ran to a different city, Harag Melech Moab, of Avi'im of Achav. So I said it incorrectly. It wasn't that Sha'ul did it. Maybe he was pressured to do so, but the king of Moab had no problem pulling the trigger. Killed out all the people of David's family. Chutz me'echad shebarach v'hichiyu nachash ha'moidi. So there's one person of all of his family that escaped, but that was it. Everyone else was wiped out. And therefore, because of this, now we can understand a little bit as to the motivation of why David wished to kill out the people from Moab. Feel better.
Thank you. Is there any talk about this Ish Nachash Ha'amoni? Do we have any knowledge?
Nachash Ha'amoni was we had him in the Shmuel Aleph. He was actually not a good person, and that's the reason why he was called Nachash, which might not have actually meant... Right. Yeah, he was not a very good person. But,
he was from...
That's not David's brother.
He's the only one that escaped.
I thought that he was only one. Yeah, when his brother escaped, and Nachash Ha'amoni had said that he helped him.
Right.
I thought there was a brother who escaped.
Yeah, it was.
Yes.
One brother escaped.
One brother escaped. That's not it. That's right. He was not the one who...
helped him.
Right. That's why the rest of the Radak says, and who achesed shomer David kasher also aviv imodi chesed. We'll see later on that in the 10th chapter that David's going to reflect back on the kindness that was done for him, that he was able to at least spare one of his brothers. So we'll go back to that idea later on.
Who spared?
That Nachash Ha'amoni was able to spare one of David's family members, namely one of his brothers. But the idea behind this entire Radak and Rashi is really coming to go back to the idea of why David was so angry and violent toward Moab. And the answer was, look what you did to my family. So it's not only that you're my enemy. You know, if you're my enemy, I can understand it, because every time you come near me, I'm going to be on guard, I'm going to protect myself. But once my guard is down and I trust you, not only do I trust you and myself, but I trust you with my most precious, my family. I give you my family. And you say, don't worry about it, it's not a problem. And then as soon as my back is turned, you kill them. All bets are off. I'm not interested in having any relationship with you. To me, you're the worst. A person who pretends to be your friend and then stabs you in the back. And that's exactly what Moab was. And therefore, for that, David felt that they deserved the greatest of punishments. So, the reality is, the initial axe that chopped its own tree, its own wood, was not David. It was really Moab, the king of Moab himself. Because he was the one that killed off people that were directly related to Moab himself. But the question again is, why did he then allow anyone to live? Why would he have allowed to have done so? And why was he able to do this? So, first of all, we know that there's this concept of Goel Hadam. This is really found when a person kills b'shogeg, manslaughter, negligently, that the person runs to the city of refuge. Where you're running from? You're running from a relative whose blood is boiling, and I'm angry that you killed someone, and therefore, if you don't hide in this city, I'm going to kill you. So some of the commentaries explain that this is a similar concept of David with Moab. And of course, it's more than just that. You can say, well, maybe it's not the exact same thing, so he had no right to do it. But it's clear that Moab was not an ally. They were enemies. And therefore, David had the right to fight against them, because they would be more than happy when David's guard is down, when David's army's guard is down, he'd probably wipe them off the map.
So is this called a preemptive war?
Could be. Yeah, that's what I think it is. He would, but it's a preemptive war, but he also used his experiences probably to draw from to realize that's what would end up happening. I can't trust them. I can't trust you because of what you did to my family in the past. So I'm going to take care of you and wipe you off the map right now.
But up until now, he never fought them? Is that possible?
But Moab.
Yeah.
He didn't have the power that he has now. I mean, he has the backing of a larger army, as all of Klal Yisrael, which he didn't before, was split. So now is the time that he's considered to be, to be able to do what he's doing. And he's also trying to, again, create atmosphere so that there will be peace in the next generation by his children. But it's kind of ironic. The only reason why Shlomo, a man of peace, it was only because of his father. It was really his father that did everything that caused to live in a generation of a more peaceful generation, that Shlomo would be able to not have to be considered a man of war, of bloodshed, of violence. If David just said, you know what, forget about it, ultimately all these people would probably have stood up, and it wouldn't have been so easy, as easy for Shlomo HaMelech. So, that's why we give a lot of credit to David, Mizmor Shir Chanukas HaBayis LeDavid, because all these things are really the starting points in order to be able to possibly have a Beis HaMikdash. Now, the Sefer Ben Yoyada explains the idea of two-thirds, and this may be a little bit mystical, maybe a little bit out there, but this is one of two possible approaches that I saw. Ben Yoyada explains that we know that when it comes to a child that is born, we believe that there is a three-way partnership. And the partnership is a Kodesh Baruch Hu Ava V'Ima, God, Father, and Mother. And therefore, once we look at it that way, that if there's three, of course, let's assume that each one has an equal involvement, which is not necessarily true, which some people have a problem with, but let's just focus on there are three, God, Father, and Mother. So now you can begin to understand the reason of this two-third, one-third split, that what David did. Because when it came to the relationship of Moab, his connection to Moab was only by his mother. And therefore, but I'm saying out of those three, right. His father was not from Moab, though. He married someone from Moab. I'm talking about the origins. He's going all the way back to Boaz and to Ruth. You're right. This is Boaz, of course, is the great grandfather of David. Right. It's not. But going all the way back to his origins, his connection to Moab was only on his mother's side. So you can say he's his great grandmother's side. Thank you. It was right, exactly. So going all the way back to his origin, it was only connected, not like people say, I'm half Scottish. And the truth is, I'm not half Scottish. I'm one third Scottish. That's how I'm supposed to say it. Because only my mother's Scottish, but there's also God and my father, who's not. And that's the same idea over here when it comes to Rus. So his connection to Moab is only at best one third, and therefore, in the schus of the relationship that he had, that his great grandmother had with Moab, he spared one third. That's how the Ben Yoyon explains it. Okay. Some say another approach, which you may like more, you may not like at all. But nonetheless, we know that when it came to Moshe Rabbeinu in Parsha Shmos, he was about to kill the Mitzri, the Egyptian that was beating up this Jew. And the Torah says, V'yarki ein ish. It says that he saw that there was no person. And the simple explanation means, he was looking around, making sure that no one's going to see him commit a crime. You know, you don't want to commit a crime when, you always see this on 10 o'clock news, you see a guy breaking in, he's like waving at the camera, you know, an idiot, there's a camera right there, and he still does it. V'yarki ein ish, so there was no one around. That's one explanation, which of course is difficult to understand because immediately afterwards he has to run away because he was, people said that he did commit a crime, so obviously he was seen. So that may be the reason why some Mefarshim explain that he looked into this person and he wondered, is there any future descendant who may possibly do anything positive that I should possibly have compassion on him and not kill him? V'yarki ein ish. So this guy, not only is this guy worthless, there's nothing good that's ever going to come from him. So some explain based on that same idea, David... This, you know, I don't really understand the two-third, one-third business, but that David was able to look into Moab and somehow figure out and calculate, like, the use of a rope. That a use of a rope is not, you know, what is a rope? A rope used to be the form of measure, especially when it came to fields. That's how they used to measure fields, with a rope. It means with an exact measurement, he would look at every single one of the people and somehow... you know, in the middle of war, with his swords flying all over the place, figure out which people had a schus to continue and who did not have a schus to continue.
Maybe he just trusted Hashem. The Hashem figured it out. He just did. I mean, he gave him
the formula every third one.
But that's exactly going against his grain, because his great grandmother is involved behind. Look what happened to her.
There was something great that came from her, though.
From her.
Right.
Only from her. Not from his great, not from her husband.
Right.
But Boaz from was her mother-in-law, but from her.
Boaz wasn't Moab. No.
No, but...
Right. So Rabbi Kahn said, so a third was because of her that he saved.
No. He said that they looked into Moab and
the second
nothing experience. Good could come out of it. Yet... Ruth was Moabiah, and something
nothing
very
came
good
out
came
of the two thirds that he killed, not
right.
The third that he didn't.
Right. He was able to.
He
was looking. That's how.
But
that's.
Maybe just Hashem that said, "Do this."
So
and
you know,
two thirds that I'm going, it'll be fine, and one third that you can't kill.
That's how some explain it, because otherwise it's difficult to understand the idea of the one third. That's why some people may like the Ben Yoyon the better. All right. It's unusual.
It's very unusual.
Right, it is very unusual. That's the reason why some of the commentaries have to grapple over what's the idea of this specific percentage, this ratio. Okay, let's continue with the next Pasuk Gimel. Let's learn about another war. Why not? Pasuk Gimel, Vayach David es Hadadezer ben Rachob Melech Tsova. So David fought this other person whose name was Hadadezer, who is the king of Tsova, or translated here in English as Zoba with a Z. Belech tachol hashav yado binahar pras. So it was to extend his control over the Nahar, over the Nahar pras, over the Euphrates River. Okay, and if we look in the Radak, the Radak tells us, so why'd you kill him? What's the deal over there, over here? Why'd you kill this person What did he really do that was so bad? And this is, I guess, you look on map 5, actually, before we look on the Radak, right? On the top, you see that he started off, he fought against, as we saw in the previous Pasuk, Moab, which is toward the bottom. And then all the way to the top of the map 4, or also more clearly on map 5, Zova, Z-O-V-A, or in Hebrew, Sova. So he fought against this individual as well because of his desire to take over and to control this the Euphrates and the Har Pras.
Right? Does it look like Lebanon, Syria, the way the JavaScript says?
Yeah, if you look actually in the English on page 251, before we see the Radak, Aram corresponds roughly to today's Syria and Lebanon. And Zoba was a kingdom somewhere within Aram. Okay? Says, which is today's well-known Syrian city of Hama, about 150 miles north of Damascus. So that's pretty clearly demonstrated on this map number 5. You have Damascus, or Damascus. And then north of it is... is this other city, Tsova. Okay. So what was the whole idea of David wanting to conquer that? I mean, after all, it seems like it's, you know, it's not really so connected to Israel. It's, as we said, it's way up there. Way up there. So the Radak discusses this. Kishahalach Hadad Ezer Lahashiv Gavula Ben Har Pras Shahi Masig Gvul Lisrael Harche Gvula Bi Artsam. He was being Masig Gvul. Masig Gvul. Right, he kept inching his way ever so closer as no one was looking. So Masig Gvul generally means I have a backyard which is adjacent to your backyard. And, you know, I don't pay any attention because I have a big backyard and so do you. And all of a sudden, I keep noticing that the fence, which was once in the middle, keeps getting much closer to my house, which ends up being my backyard is shrinking and yours is getting larger. That's being hasagas gvul. We also have this halachic concept when it comes to
business,
right? And that's a very difficult and sticky question about how many pizza shops can you open up on the same block. And it depends, apparently. Depends on which community you are. Depends on a lot of things, which certainly is beyond the scope of just a short conversation. But nonetheless, this is what David was noticing with this king, Hadadezer. Yes, he was way up there, but he was inching his way ever so slowly to try to take over more and more of the promised land. And therefore, for that reason, David felt that there was one easy way for that to stop, and that way was kill him. Pasuk Dalet.
Where is Nahar
Pras? Euphrates? Is that on this map somewhere?
No.
I have to get a better map for next time. This is taken from the Ma'am Loewe's English version. But it's up there. Okay, let's continue with the next pasuk. Let's see pasuk Dalet. We're flying today. Vayilko David mimenu elef u'shva meos perashim v'esrim elef ish ragli. Any members of Peter will not want to hear this pasuk, so please bear with me. Vayilko David mimenu elef u'shva meos. So David captured, doesn't say he killed, but he captured 1,700 Parashim, horsemen, and not only that, but Esrim Elef Ishragli, 20,000 men of feet, soldiers that were walking. He captured them. The Yakar Dov, so let me stop in the middle of that pasuk. The Radak on the top of page 252 says, V'lomer v'yach. It doesn't say that he killed them. Nira ki lo hiko mehem. He didn't kill them. He jumped a couple lines. V'lomer mehem pidin nafsham. He asked, he wanted them for ransom. So everything David did was strategic. It was a way to accumulate more and more wealth because the Beis Hamikdash was going to be a very expensive structure to build. So he used all these different opportunities. Sometimes he killed, sometimes he didn't kill. But this was a way for him to amass more wealth.
He has to support an army.
That's also true, right? Exactly. So now let's see the rest of this pasuk, which I would love to skip. V'yakir David es kol harechev v'yosir menu meya rechev. Let's see how it's translated. David hamstrung all the horses, but he left over some of the horses, 100 chariots. So for enough horses to be able to pull 100 chariots. It's more than 100 horses.
Four horses to a chariot.
Okay. So, but he did not use all of his horses. So there's a few questions. The first question is, what does it mean he hamstrung them? Obviously, he did something to injure these horses. So that,
why did he give them to the people? I don't understand. If he couldn't keep them himself, why didn't he give them to the Jewish people? There were a whole lot of people fighting. Maybe he could have given each one a horse.
So let's begin. There's a lot of good questions. Let's start off with the Radak. Maybe the Radak will answer that question. Maybe it'll cause us to have more problems. Yeah. So let's see what the Radak does. So if we look on the second wide line, which is underlined, with Ishu us. So the first question the Radak grapples over is, why did he do this? Why did he just keep all these wonderful horses for himself? Lefishu usur l'harbo sus. Right. He's a king. And a king apparently is not allowed to have many horses. Where is that written? It's written in the Torah. Kamosha Kasav, Lo Yarbe Lo Susim. You're not allowed to have too many horses. And we see from this idea a couple of things. One thing we see is that the prohibition is not only for a king to purchase horses, but they can't be given them, and he also cannot get them as spoils of war. He cannot take them either for that as well. It's not that he cannot just purchase them. And the pasuk actually, we'll talk a little bit more, says because we're afraid he may go back to the place where the best horses are bred, which is namely the country of Mitzrayim, right, to Egypt. But apparently it doesn't make a difference if he buys them. He's just not allowed to be in ownership of them. Which is also a question that the Rogachover asks, is what happens if, let's say, I'm not a king, and for some reason I love horses, and I have billions of horses, and all of a sudden they decide, you know what, Rabbi Tomsky, you're a good guy, we're going to make you a king. So the question is, do I have to get rid of those horses? On one hand, does it mean a king is not allowed to purchase them, and a king's allowed to have them? Or does it mean, if I had them before, but now that I'm a king, I'm not going to buy any? So maybe that's not a problem. Do I have to get rid of them? That's a question based on the words of Radak.
Weakness of Melo Shlomo also too many horses?
Right. Absolutely. I wouldn't put them in the same category. The Torah does put them in the same category, but I wouldn't put them in the same category.
That's just for a melech, not for an individual.
Only for a melech, right. A person can have as many horses as they'd like. Continuing in the Radak. So now we understand why he wasn't allowed to have that many horses. So the question is, if he's not allowed to have them, so then just kill them. So the Radak says, no. V'lahamisim, we're not going to kill them. Well, if you just pull a trigger right next to the head of a horse, it was not ever in any pain. It dies instantaneously. There's no tzar b'alechayim. V'lahamisim, ki asur l'hashlis. Well, that may be what. Right, that's what the Radak says. Ki asur l'hashlis davar nivra derech hashchasa im lo hayamazik. You're not allowed to kill and destroy things. The only exception is if it's a mazik. If you have a rabid dog, you have an animal that killed someone, that's dangerous, so you're allowed to put it to sleep. We're allowed to do that because we're concerned it may do it again.
So if the animal is dying, I mean, like if the horse is in pain.
Right. So those are ways you're allowed to do it. or Odover Sh'asr Bahana. For whatever reason, maybe there's something which you're not allowed to halachically derive any benefit from. So then it's walking around and serving absolutely no purpose. And not only that, maybe someone else will get their hands on it and end up using it when they shouldn't. So those are the only reasons why a person is allowed to destroy an animal. But Tzedavadi felt those were not legitimate reasons that don't fall into his categories. Therefore, he cannot own them, and he cannot kill them. Here's another reason. Olimchos zecher kamo ba'amolik shnerim ki mishor bi'ad se migamal ve'ad chamor. We're going to actually use that pasuk and ask a question later on when we get next time to pasuk Yud Beis. But also, if you amalek, everything of amalek is not to be destroyed. Even their beautifully groomed horses, you have to kill, which is hard to understand. It wasn't just hard for me to understand, it was hard for Shaul to understand, which ultimately was his mistake, one of his major mistakes. So, says the Radak, V'akram, so therefore he uprooted them, or as it's translated, he hamstrung them. Kedei shol yichu mehem anshei achayil. He did something so that they were no longer fit to be used as... Right. V'ikar hoser besusi ha'oivim kedei shelo yilchamu mehem od l'Yisrael. So they would no longer be used against the Jewish people. So the question still is, so why didn't he give it to his army? Why didn't he give it to the Jewish people? And the only answer that I heard, which may not make a lot of sense, but nonetheless, is that he was concerned that maybe ultimately would eventually fall back into enemy hands. Somehow, these horses may have been trained, and maybe the soldiers themselves were trained also to know how to ride them. Maybe his soldiers didn't have that training. They probably didn't. And they would really have no use for them. And therefore, it's easy that they could have been just somehow brought back to the enemies, sold to the enemies, and therefore he'd want to make sure that didn't happen. But the one other question that the Mefarshim deal with is Sar Balichai, right? He did cause physical pain to these animals. And on this, and this is a tremendous discussion, which fortunately it's 10:30, so I can sneak out of that. No. I'm just going to say it very quickly and hopefully you forget about it by next week. No, joking. Is the halacha of Tsar Balichayim only is if there's no toelus. There's no purpose or benefit. However, if on the other end of the spectrum, on the other side of the coin, you can derive, there's a purpose in the pain that you caused it, then measuring it on a case-to-case basis, it could be permissible. And therefore, what is the toelus? The toelus is, the purpose, the benefit, is what danger these horses could be that if they fall back into enemy hands, it's going to kill potentially thousands of Jews. And therefore, he had to weigh this decision. He couldn't do anything else with them. He couldn't kill them. He couldn't keep them for himself. He was afraid to give them away because they weren't regular horses, so no one else could use them. So he had to cause a little bit of pain so that they were still horses and they could still be used, but no longer for war, because he was concerned the downside would be so much worse than the amount of pain that those animals would bear. And therefore, for that reason, some of the commentators explain that's the reason why Tsar Balichayim, in this instance, is permissible. Stop here.